Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at external factors like exercise and whether or not they can affect how your genes work. And I mean G-E-N-E-S, not the kind you put on your...
All that does come into play, too.
It may come into play. Oh, man. Can exercise help you fight disease and maybe live longer? Larry Mueller here. Thanks again for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our physical therapist back with us to help explain this connection. In the studio with me, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see you.
It's great to be here.
Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health's Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to see you too.
Awesome to be here.
What's your opinion as you listen to these two experts talk? What's your opinion on the effects of regular exercise on your ability to fight disease? You can join the conversation. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of this. The study of epigenetics, very interesting field of science, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, tell us about epigenetics.
Well, so for our listeners, the term epigenetics refers to the study of how regular exposure to environmental factors. And for me, the big three are exercise, nutrition, and stress.
Right.
Can promote the expression or repression of certain genes. So epigenetic technically means above the genome, and it refers to processes that guide and direct the expression of genes that are contained in your genome. So it doesn't change your DNA, but it can affect which genes are supported or expressed and which ones are repressed. And we're just beginning to understand some of this, but some of the most potent factors that affect this are exercise, nutrition, and stress. So I think we've talked about good nutrition and exercise here on this show before.
Right.
So how does it fit into physical therapy?
Well, I think that's a great question. And as a physical therapist, one of the most common interventions that I provide my patient, regardless of whether the patient has an orthopedic condition, a neurological condition, or a cardiovascular condition, is exercise. And it comes down to the type of exercise that's most appropriate for that patient, whether it's cardiovascular, whether it's strength training. But as a physical therapist, one of the biggest things I do is educate my patient and provide them with the appropriate exercise to overcome their pathology or in prevention and wellness.
Right. And one of the issues is, as physical therapists, and this is one of the things that we're working on as a profession, is we see people for a limited, what we call an episode of care. Someone comes in, they've had knee surgery or hip pain or back pain or you name it, and then we see them for a certain amount of time and a certain number of visits to, as we say, sort of help dig them out of the hole and get them back on a baseline where they can function. Unfortunately, often physical therapy ends there, but what we know from the early data and studies of epigenetics is these changes happen over prolonged periods of time. You can't participate in a rehabilitation program for 8 weeks or 12 weeks or 15 weeks and then expect these changes at the genome level to be maintained. They have to be sustained. So one of the things we have to look at as a profession is how to help our patients sustain that exercise program that we've helped them initiate.
So regular exercise then makes a difference.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, along with nutrition and stress. And part of what also comes with controlling stress, and I think this is an important consideration, is sleep hygiene. And that's one of the things as a physical therapist we also discuss with our patients is the importance of not only working your muscles, but making sure that they have adequate time to recover. And so I think, although it's really defined as a three-tiered approach, I think one of the things that would fall under the stress category would certainly be really good sleep hygiene.
Absolutely.
So you wonder about, is there any possibility that these effects may be passed down to offspring?
Well, yes, there is research typically in mice that have shown that exposure to, they had them exposed to pesticides, and they exposed one generation to the pesticide, and 90% of the changes to the genome as a result of the pesticide exposure in the mother were still evident four generations later.
Wow.
So we don't know if that's true for all changes to the genome, but there is evidence that certainly within an organism, so that is within you, Larry, as you exercise on a regular basis, when you have cell turnover in your muscles or anywhere in your body, that that genomic change is maintained. So we know within an organism, if you exercise on a regular basis, as your cells reproduce, that that change, that beneficial change to the genetic code has maintained. How much of that is passed on through generations is still in its infancy in terms of research.
And the other thing, the other challenge with all of this is the whole concept of it gets passed on genetically. Does it also get passed on through example? So you exercise and you're a chronic exerciser and you have good, healthy nutrition. So part of that is you will pass those behaviors via example onto your children. So not only is it a genetic factor, but it could also be that your lifestyle and behavior can play a significant role as well. So now you kind of have this two-tiered approach or this coming at it from both sides, if you will.
Makes sense. You wonder how, is it used right now in, say, treating illnesses, or what's the prognosis on that?
Well, it's still relatively new. The biggest, most robust area of research is in cancer, obviously, because they're looking at how genes are expressed or repressed and how that affects cancer. They've also found that they're also studying a lot in rheumatologic diseases like lupus and diabetes.
As well as
obesity. So I'd say those are the big ones: cancer, diabetes, obesity, and rheumatologic diseases.
But we know from so many studies with regards to whether it's an orthopedic condition or a neurological condition, like I talked about, or a cardiovascular condition, some of the conditions we see in physical therapy, one of the biggest common denominators in people who get better is the use of exercise and staying on their exercise program for a prolonged period of time. And it comes down to making sure that that exercise program is conducive to them based on their impairments or their functional limitations, whether it's arthritis in their knee or it's some sort of neurologic condition. But exercise seems to be a very common intervention that seems to provide positive outcomes in almost any condition we see in physical therapy.
Absolutely. And again, that prescription, as you discussed, Jill, you know, the things we're still trying to figure out in terms of the genome are the dosage of exercise, frequency, intensity, duration, mode of exercise. But we have seen over and over again, those people who continue the exercise program are the ones who are most successful. And I always think back to a certain patient who I saw who was almost 5 years later after my seeing her was still exercising and came up to me and she said, "You didn't tell me it was going to take 5 years, but I am so much better."
So, there you go.
Well, you know, Carlene in Brooklyn has a comment relating to this. Carlene, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for addressing this. I have to agree that I do think that exercise certainly helps me fight off not necessarily diseases, but chronic illnesses like colds and things like that. I find that if I continue to exercise and do other things, not to the point of exhaustion, that I do feel better. I feel like it's not beating me, and maybe it's psychological, but I do feel better. So that's just a plug for perhaps it's bigger than that. I have a question regarding when is physical therapy versus and some sort of orthopedic surgical intervention, when is it time? I'm 60. I have a chronically bad knee. I have arthritis in that knee as well as soft tissue pain. And I am trying really hard to make a decision about whether or not to have surgery because this knee is limiting my ability to exercise. And I'm so tired of it.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head is when you see two things really need to happen. You have to really have exhausted conservative care before you go into surgery. And I think conservative care not only consists of physical therapy with regards to strengthening, pain management, exercise, then other conservative care, which would include any sort of medication, oral medication, or some sort of injections. Once you exhaust all of those, then I think it's time to consider surgery. And this is kind of a broad question because all surgeries are not the same. So are you considering just a debridement, or are you considering having something mechanically done? What is your surgery that you're considering, Carlene?
Well, I've had a meniscus surgery 10 years ago.
Yeah,
11 years ago. I'm very physically active in spite of the pain. But I do find that I don't do things that I would do. For instance, I don't run. I walk for long distances, but I don't run, which also means that I don't play sports that I enjoy that include running. And my knee is in constant soreness and sometimes acute pain. So I'm finding it very limiting and very frustrating.
So are you thinking about a total knee replacement? Is that where you're going?
That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I don't see you returning to running
right
after a total knee.
Right.
So if that's your goal, the total knee isn't going to get you there. So
I wonder, have you had injections? You mentioned
the Syndesc injections or there's some
Man,
sort
they
of...
really work for me.
Right. Have you had other interventions?
About that, because I've had injections in my thumb. I have basal joint arthritis in my thumb, and the injections themselves are so painful and did not give me the kind of payoff. I had it done 3 times, and it just got to the point that I said, the pain from the injection is not worth it's a cost benefit analysis.
Correct. Right. I hear you.
But I will say that injecting a thumb is more painful than injecting a knee.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing.
It's not the same at all.
Yeah. Well, and my guess is in your thumb you had cortisone injections. At the knee there are certainly cortisone injections, but they also have injections called Syndesc that are a lubrication that sometimes buy you a little time. So really what you're doing, Carlene, is you're trying to buy yourself as much time as you can before you have to go to the total joint replacement. So I wouldn't dismiss an injection in your knee because of your experience with your thumb. I wouldn't use that as my criteria for deciding that. I'd probably get a little more information about what injections might be available to you, and I'd maybe try that before I jumped into the total joint.
Right.
Just in my own experience, I think I had to have 3 injections over a 3-week period, and then it took about another 3 or 4 weeks before I called and canceled my surgery because I had no pain, and that was 8 years ago, and I still don't have any pain.
Yeah.
Although, so it's worth a try. I think, you know, Carlene's talking about the cost-benefit analysis, and it sounds like the experience in your thumb was not good, but I agree with Lori. I wouldn't base not getting an injection in my knee on that. I think the outcomes are much, much better, and the type of injection is different, as Lori said.
Good luck. Call back and let us know.
Yeah, let us know.
Thanks so much for that call, Carlene. Visiting today with Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, our engineer, Tyler Ditter, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at physical therapy issues today, exercise, genetics, all kinds of things with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our physical therapists who come by once a month to talk about these kinds of issues. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. All our lines are filled, so we'll go back to the phones. And Jim in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I am calling with a couple of questions about my back condition. I have a number of issues with my lower back and in my upper back too, but the main problem is in the lower back with spinal stenosis, severe facet, I believe is what you... Facet disease. And I also have bulging disc and disc issues, and I'm pretty active for having all those problems. But what my other question is, I'd like to get some general advice. You know, I've seen physical therapists before, and they kind of say, you know, we've done about as much as we can do for you. But some general advice about treating. I mean, like things I can do for myself. You know, in terms of I swim. You know, I ride a recumbent bike. I sometimes have trouble walking. You know, I get severe pains in my legs and in my thighs, and, you know, especially in my ankles sometimes. And they also say I have neuropathy, and I don't know whether that's caused from... how do you know... that's another question, is how do you know whether your neuropathy is caused by the, you know, the stenosis... or disc problems, or whether it's caused by, I don't have diabetes, kind of a thing. So I was just kind of wondering.
Right. So, Well, I think, I mean, riding a recumbent bike for somebody like Jim is great, because it sounds like his stenosis is coming from his facet joints, and we want to kind of open that space up. So doing something where you're biased into flexion is a really good strategy. So riding a recumbent bike is really good.
You said you have facet disease. Do you know if you have only facet stenosis, or do you have central canal stenosis? Do you know?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, that would be one question to... I would get an answer to that question, because really you treat stenosis that's a result of facet disease only differently than you would treat central canal stenosis. And when you tell me that you have symptoms in both legs, it makes me wonder if you have central canal stenosis, which is a much more difficult problem to deal with than facet. So for the listeners, the facets are the small little synovial joints that sort of attach one vertebrae to the next as they're stacked up one on another. And when you have arthritis in those facet joints, it's not unlike a knee that has arthritis, where it swells on occasion. So times when you're very active, when you're really loading those facet joints, as in a rotational activity, for example, or a lot of weight bearing, and you combine that with a disc herniation, both of those things encroach on the space where your nerve roots come out. So when you're up in a gravity position, whether you're standing or sitting in one position for a long period of time, those things will encroach on that space, and they'll typically give you symptoms in a referral pattern on one side of your body. However, if you have central canal stenosis, then you're getting pressure on the spinal cord itself within the spinal canal, and that will give you symptoms on both sides. And that's, you have to be much more careful with that, and it's much more difficult to treat. So I think, you know, seeing somebody who can give you the answer to whether or not you have just facet stenosis or central canal could give you better information about what you should do. But as Jill said, generally, recumbent biking is good and swimming is good in both of those situations.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's turn to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I developed neuropathy in my legs about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's gotten to a point where I can just barely walk. Is there any way exercise can help me on that?
Well, I'll start. So Jim had a question about neuropathy, too, that we didn't quite get to. So to some extent, it depends upon what's causing your neuropathy. Right. Sometimes neuropathy comes from compression of nerves coming out of your spinal cord, in which case we treat your back, as we talked about in Jim's case, where you have facet disease or disc disease, and it puts pressure on a nerve root, and it gives you neuropathy. Some people have neuropathy due to diabetes. And again, Jim said he didn't have diabetes, but people who have diabetes have a tendency to have neuropathy. Some people have what's called small fiber neuropathy for reasons that are unknown. So, and you know, the first question is, do you know what's causing it? Has anyone told you what's causing your neuropathy?
No, they don't know what it is. I don't have diabetes.
Okay, that's good.
I don't have back problems or anything like that. Or they just call it peripheral neuropathy.
Yeah, neuropathic pain. Yeah.
So in general, I would have to say physical therapy doesn't get rid of your neuropathy. It doesn't change your neuropathy when it's neuropathy of unknown origin like yours. But what it does is it can help keep you strong despite your neuropathy. Some people find that regular exercise, when it's dosed correctly, can help with their pain and their symptoms, but it has to be dosed correctly. I see a number of people in the pool with this type of neuropathy because it's one place where they don't have all the effects of gravity and they can work at a little bit lower level and get themselves built up some.
Right. And the other thing is you don't want this neuropathic pain to decondition you to make you be at risk for other issues. So you still want to, as Lori said, keep your strength up, make sure you have a good cardiovascular base, and even from an epigenetic perspective, to keep your immune system healthy to fight off other conditions.
Right, and that was one of the things, and I'm glad you brought that up, Jill, that we talked about in terms of epigenetics, and that is people who have a limited capacity to exercise are really at risk for a lot of these other kinds of problems. And so one of our goals is for cases like Mike is to help him figure out a way that he can exercise on a regular basis to maintain his overall health and ward off other kinds of diseases or comorbidities.
So there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much, Mike, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll move to another caller, Jim, in Stevens Point. Your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. A comment and a question. The comment is that I had two major back surgeries back in the 1980s, and I immediately went to a swimming exercise. And these days I can swim, walk, and ride a bike. So I'm really fortunate.
That's great.
With that. Yeah. My question has to do with your comment about sleep hygiene. And I need a new bed. And, you know, there's a zillion beds out there. And when you go online, everybody seems to be probably paid for whatever they're saying.
How do you go about
finding a good bed?
That is a great question, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to turn it over to Lori, because I believe that you had a sleep specialist. Didn't you have somebody called in one time and gave you recommendations? So first of all, I think your life expectancy of your mattress is only 7 or 8 years old, and that after that, you definitely need to get a new bed. I know that many stores now have the 90-night sleep guarantee, something like that. So when you purchase a mattress, make sure that you have that. So if you're not satisfied, you can do an exchange, which I think is really important. I think the biggest thing is, I guess my biggest thing is I wouldn't want a mattress that's too soft. I think if you go too firm, you can make a mattress softer by getting an egg crate or putting a feather bed or something like that on it. I think it's very challenging to make a bed that's too soft firm.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's hard to, as Jill said, to go in and lay on a mattress for 2 minutes and have any idea if it's going to be the right one for you.
Correct.
So I would say one of the things I would stop and think about is, well, how is my mattress at home? If I go sleep on a different bed in my house, how is that? If I sleep in a hotel, how's that? If I sleep on a futon, how's that? And get a sense of where you're at in that sort of softer, firmer, feather top category. And then the mattress person who called in one time said, for the first 6 months, you are to rotate your mattress every month.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you have a bad back, you better get some good friends who can help you with that. But in terms of breaking your mattress in, they said you should rotate it every month for 6 months.
I wonder about these sleep number type mattresses that you can adjust the...
I've seen them. I have no personal experience with them, so I don't know anything about them, nor do I know what the difference is between the lowest number and the highest numbers. Are really that dramatic of a difference? Jim brings up a great question, because mattresses are not inexpensive. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about a big investment. You spend a third of your life there, as they say on TV all the time. But I do think that knowing, like Lori said, get a feel for what's best for you is very important. And then the other thing is knowing that you can, augment this by using positioning things such as wedges and body pillows and things like that also within that. So it's not just the mattress itself, but it's how you kind of design your nest, for lack of better terms, to make sure it meets your body.
Well, some of them you even adjust the bed itself.
Right, exactly.
Raise it up in different places.
Exactly.
I love the full body pillows.
Me too.
That you can just, we call it forward side lying and backward side lying, where you're not exactly on your front or on your back or on your side, but you're like at a 45, and you can really reposition yourself a lot of ways with those.
Right. I have a body pillow and I love it. I can't imagine not sleeping with it. No. It's very important.
Without it,
that too. Yes. Sorry.
There you go.
Sorry.
There you go, Jim. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. We'll turn to Steve in Madison next. Steve, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, I heard the prior caller talking about knee issues, and that's what's bedeviling me. Both my knees pretty much blew up at more or less the same time. And in the summer this year, I was walking 2 miles a day and biking 30, 40 miles a week. And now I'm struggling just to get around. All my meniscuses are torn. I have had the steroid shot in both knees. I had the synovial fluid shot in my right knee. But they remain swollen. And, with the icy weather and whatnot, I live on a second floor flat. I'm just scared about getting around and, being able to survive the winter. So any thoughts you have about what I can do to get more strength and less pain, I'd be very grateful.
Well, have you seen a physical therapist?
I have, yeah. And I saw the therapist for back and hip problems, and that was... in evaluation, that was where the knee problems began. Something blew up in my knee, and I've been downhill ever since.
I think it's probably time to... It sounds like you have a lot going on with hip problems, back problems. It's probably time to see a physical therapist who can step back and look at all of you, because I hear you say you're trying to be active, which is wonderful. Walking, biking, those are all good things for you. But now your injury... your impairments are preventing you from doing those activities, and I hear you have concerns about going out in the ice. So it's time to see somebody and get on a good program, I think.
So have you exercised in a pool at all?
I have a little, but not on a regular basis. Okay. And I'd be interested in
that's,
that.
That's a great idea.
I think that would be a great place for you, because in the pool, a lot of the things that we do there can work on your back, your hips, your knees, and your balance all at the same time. And a well-constructed program can kind of put all those things together in a few exercises and see if we can help get you going. If that fails, it seems as though you've really tried everything else. And if you're meniscus or shredded, that causes problems, and the swelling that you see in your knees, it may be difficult to beat that back, but we'll have to see.
I agree. I think the pool is a good place to start
and
to
work
on
Madison.
All of those.
Yeah, you're in Madison.
Pools.
Yep.
Yes, exactly.
We have pools.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And we turn to Ken in Mayville next. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing? I've got, I guess they call it like reverse tennis elbow in my left arm, where it really sore on the inside of my elbow. And my former job, I had some physical therapy, and they did some taping, and some of that stuff seemed to help. But then recently it's come back, and it seems to come back with a vengeance. And I've heard some people say isolate it, some people say just put a band around it, some people say don't do anything, just keep exercising it. And I've kind of been going with the exercising it, or, you know, not babying it. I'm not doing any specific exercises, but is there some specific exercise that I should be doing that would strengthen it so it isn't as sore? Or?
Yeah, but let's back up for a second. So first of all, are you right or left-handed?
Right-handed.
Okay, right-handed, and this is your left elbow, and we would call this golfer's elbow is actually what it's called. Was there something in your former job you did that required manual labor or the use of your upper extremities?
Yeah, I'm a chef by trade.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, so you're gripping tools and using a lot of fine motor skills. Hey, what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
We can do a little trade
we
here.
We could totally do a trade. No, but in all seriousness, so you're using, you know, tools that require you to grip and do a lot of fine motor skills, which is an issue.
So in terms of the establishing the baseline thing, so number one, see if you can find tools that are ergonomically correct,
right,
that fit your hand so that you don't have to excessively grip for that. So that would be step one. And then the band. So the band essentially creates a new insertion for that muscle, which is a wrist flexor that's giving you trouble. So wearing that when you're really active, when you're at work and you have to be gripping and doing stuff, is a reasonable thing to do. And then thereafter, doing strengthening. And there's some controversy over how hard to strengthen these. So the backstory is we used to baby these a little bit and be very careful not to increase the inflammation there until we discovered that really there wasn't a lot of inflammation there. And sometimes people would call in and say, well, I did everything I was supposed to do and it didn't get better. So I just went to the gym and I lifted really heavy and it got better. And we kind of went, oh, isn't that
right,
nice?
Yeah.
But now there's research to support that in some cases, doing really heavy lifting on that muscle actually helps it to get better.
Right. So I think because this affects your livelihood, it would behoove you to see a physical therapist or an occupational therapist to get this a little bit under control. And the occupational therapist may have some good resources for you regarding ergonomically designed kitchen tools.
Right. But I would encourage you to see somebody who has expertise, really expertise in orthopedics or
yes.
sports.
Yes.
Because if you go see somebody who just gives you some stretching and, you know, a strengthening with the 1 pound weight, I don't think it's going to get you there. I think you have to have somebody who really understands this kind of a problem.
Right.
Good luck. Thank you so much, Ken, for calling. Appreciate it. And Lisa in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment for the callers that were calling in with their neuropathy pain issues. I had to go through chemo for cancer, and I ended up with some bad neuropathy in my hands and feet and struggled with it for years. And I did keep exercising because I wasn't going to sit around, but I recently changed my diet and cut out almost all processed sugar and lowered my carbs. And believe it or not, within 2 to 3 weeks, my pain literally disappeared, and I have no more pain. So I don't know if, you know, dietary could be part of some of the issues that are going on with other callers. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
It's a great point. So Lisa had mentioned bringing out or taking out sugar and kind of simple carbohydrates, which are highly processed foods, which are considered inflammatory. So they can kind of trigger inflammation. So the question is, if I take out those inflammatory triggers, can that my inflammation decrease and can that control my pain or my neuropathy? And it sounds like anecdotal for her, it did, which is great. So we're seeing that, and we encourage that with a lot of our athletes to also avoid eating an inflammatory diet.
Thank you so much for that comment. Let's turn to Joyce and Nina next. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, I just want to encourage
an earlier caller, the woman who has chronic knee pain. I think she was one of the first callers. I had a lot of chronic knee pain. I had knee pain in the last, 10 to 15 years. I had ACL reconstruction when I was young, 25, and that was fine for, 10 years. But then as I started working out a lot in my 30s. I'm 52 now. And so I've had to change up my routine because of this knee pain. I swim, I do run on the treadmill, and I do run outside. But what I do that I think makes a difference for me, and maybe for her it would help, I ice regularly. Mm-hmm. I ice my knee every night, especially after I've ran earlier in the day. And I can work out the next morning. It feels good. But by the next night, and I'm on my feet a lot during the day, I ice again. I ice my knee, plus I have a posterior tibia tendonitis problem. And I'm icing my foot, and I'm icing my knee. I don't know. I do it 20 minutes a night. I do it when I'm reading in bed at night, and I just put them in the freezer when I wake up, and I'm doing it the next night. Is that crazy? I mean, it works for me.
No, it's not it's not crazy at all. We know that icing can help reduce inflammation. And what you're talking about, especially, is if that swelling is very superficial, particularly with your posterior tibialis tendon, that we know that the ice could potentially penetrate deep enough to help with that. So it's not crazy at all. I think it's a great strategy. It's very inexpensive and absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And it works for you. Right. So perfect.
Yeah. Thanks for that comment. I appreciate it very much. And Christine in Milwaukee. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have been diagnosed with late-stage Lyme disease. I had my hips replaced 35 days apart, half a shoulder, because that's all we could put in. Scheduled for a complete knee replacement. They call me for foot surgery. Do people get to the point where when things are so severe, is exercise going to hurt me more than help me?
Oh, that's a really great question.
It is. I think it comes down to the type of exercise. So exercise may be beneficial, but it's all about the type of exercise you're doing specifically when you're kind of in an acute flare-up. It's no different than a patient who has rheumatoid arthritis, and we know when their joints are in a flare-up type of period, we don't want to do aggressive exercise, and we don't want to overwork those joints.
So typically, in those phases, we do activities that decrease pain. So we look at exercise as pain relief, not exercise to build strength or endurance. So you may have different exercise programs that you use depending upon how your joints are. So, for example, when we see people in the pool, if they are in a flare, they may come and just unweight their joints. They may do a little walking in the deeper water or just hang to unweight and let the hydrostatic pressure help with their swelling and movement for pain relief rather than trying to push for strengthening.
I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all sorts of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. We have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rich in Green Bay emailed to say he believed he heard that tinnitus can be treated with physical therapy. Is that true? And if so, how does it work?
Yes, it depending on what the source of your tinnitus, which is ringing in your ears, is, it can be treated via physical therapy. There are physical therapists who specialize in vestibular rehabilitation, which is rehabilitation due to inner ear dysfunction. So if Rich's condition is truly due to a canal issue within his ear, it can be treated with physical therapy in just a few visits. How does it work? It works by Well, I like to say putting your rocks back on your blocks. But what can happen is if you get an inner ear dysfunction, your fluid in your canals can come, for lack of better terms, off kilter. And there are certain movement techniques that physical therapists can do to kind of restore the fluid within your inner ear.
Oh, very interesting. There we go. Thanks, Rich, for that email. Let's take another call. John in Brown Deer, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning, and thank you for accepting my call. And I just would like to comment on the intensity of exercise that I assume most of your callers are trying to maintain. I am 73 years old, and I have lower back stenosis, and I'm also recuperating from a fractured right femur. And I found that the that over the past number of years, 5 years or so, that I put myself on an exercise program that maintains my weight, and it just maintains my cardiovascular and cardiopulmonary health. And I eliminated all sugars from my processed sugars from my diet, and derive my sugar from natural fruit and vegetables. And I also try to consume meat products that are natural and unprocessed. And I've been successful at that. And I've been maintaining my weight at approximately 140 pounds, fluctuating within 2 or 3 pounds of that. But my comment is that people don't have to exercise, especially as one becomes older, at a level that would probably be done by a person training for the Olympics or some type of athletic event.
Right.
All they're doing is succeeding in injuring themselves further and looking for ways to alleviate the pain and the miserable feelings that they derive from that pain, and trying to maintain a very rigorous and strenuous exercise regimen, and it's totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, John. That's great information. I think, you know, as I thought about this, and I thought about the epigenetics and exercise and stress, and how for some people, the feeling of, oh, I have to go exercise actually increases their stress, so they
right.
sort of cancel each other out.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. It doesn't have to be so intense. On the other hand, I would say, epidemiologically, as a population, our bigger problem is people who under-exercise, not people who over-exercise. American College of Sports Medicine says 150 minutes per week, and it doesn't have to be in all at once. It can be
moderate,
in little 10-minute blocks, but 150 minutes a week.
Right, and they're actually changing their guidelines even once again, that saying those little 10-minute episodes are far better than doing nothing at all. And the interesting thing, just to follow up with Lori, is there's a fascinating study that will be published next month that looked at people's compliance with home exercise program and their self-reporting. And what they did is they gave them cuff weights and to put on their ankles, and they prescribed them 3 strengthening exercises. And what the subjects didn't know is that there was an accelerometer in the cuff, so they could actually determine exactly precisely how many exercises the patients did. And then they had the patients self-report, so the patients were blinded. And what they found is that patients, as a general rule, overestimate the amount of exercise they do by about 20%. So
right.
Yeah. So I totally understand what John is saying, and I do agree with him that, you know, everybody should have the correct prescribed program. But on the other hand, we have to make sure that people are actually doing what they say they're doing.
Yeah. There we go. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. And Sullivan in Green Bay, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. First of all, thank you for taking my call. Secondly, so I have a friend who has a functional disorder, which basically means that her brain cannot process stress properly. So eventually it builds up into a seizure, a very severe seizure. And so over the past 2 weeks or so, she's been having quite a few of them and has ended up losing function in her legs. So she is confined to a wheelchair now. I just wanted to know what sorts of exercises she can do to rebuild the strength in her leg. We do have access to a pool.
Okay. Is she safe to participate in activities in a pool with her seizure disorder?
I would assume so.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be the first right. barrier. So is she able to walk?
Very slightly.
Okay. So a pool would be a great place for her to start. So putting her in the deeper water. So if she's immersed, you know, approximately to her neck, she'll be roughly 25% weight bearing. So holding on to a noodle or something. And I would say if I were the treating therapist, I would want someone in the pool right. with her if she has a seizure disorder, not knowing how the stress of the pool might impact her. So just walking forward, backward, sideways would be a great start, and then simple things like leg lifts to the front and to the side, squats. Then the idea would be to progress her from deeper water to shallower water. And then at home, simple sit to stand is probably as good as anything, and right. that is practicing standing up from the wheelchair and sitting back down, you know, 10 times every hour on the hour.
Right, and trying to minimize how much she uses her arms with that. So she's yeah. truly, really using her legs. And that would be yeah. a really good place to start.
Yeah.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Sullivan. And we'll turn to Chris in Adams next. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I have fibromyalgia and MS, and I also have celiac disease, and I'm completely allergic to all cereal grains. I wanted to just expound a little bit on the lady that called in about the anti-inflammatory diet, because I have become the expert in anti-inflammatory diet. And the problem for a lot of people is that they don't know. There's a lot of hidden simple carbs in foods, and it doesn't say, hi, my hidden simple carb. It's listed as methylcellulose or natural right. flavors or modified food starch, and it's in places that you would never, ever expect it, like dairy products, shredded cheese, all kinds of places. The stuff that they inject into your turkey has it in it. And so doing that and just saying, well, I'm going to give up my candy bars and stuff isn't going to be enough, people. You have to take all of this stuff out of your diet. The best way to do this is just eliminate it completely and then try one thing at a time. And I've also gotten rid of legumes and the nightshade vegetables, which is really, that's a hassle. But you really have to do that. Do a colon cleanse. Get all the goop out of your diet. Do an herbal cleanse. And then start adding things one at a time. And right, believe right. me, you will figure this out. You will understand what your body is. And then put some turmeric in your diet and some fresh ginger and sweet potatoes, and things will be better. I can promise you that. It's the difference between my laying on my couch moaning and being vertical and able to do things. It's that
right. that yep. simple.
Hmm. And Chris brings up a good point of introducing things, you know, one at a time. So basically, as a patient, you become a single subject study. And so just because another person can have it who's doing an elimination diet doesn't mean you can or whatever. So you have to see what your body tolerates and pay close attention to that. Keep a good food diary.
Right. And that could be related to epigenetics as well.
Correct.
So one of the things that they're not, that we're just starting to understand is that one activity or one environmental factor that may be positive may trigger, in combination with other changes, things that are negative. And so everyone's genome is a little bit different. So while an anti-inflammatory diet for Chris may require her removing all these things to work for her, it may look slightly different for somebody right. else. And those are the parts of this that we're just starting to uncover.
Yeah, good points. Thank you, Chris, for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy in Monroe, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, good morning. This has been very informative. Thanks for taking my call, and it's a good listen. I'm dealing with really chronic sciatica, and I've been in the pool for probably about the last 8 weeks, 3-4 times a week, and it just seems to not go away.
Mm. All right. So have you, are you under the care of a physician as well, or do you know where the origin of the sciatica is? Is it your spine? Is it your hip? Do you know?
Well, I actually am a patient at UW orthopedic, and I went there initially for knee problems, and it actually isn't my knee that's hurting anymore. It's my, my rear end. So.
Okay.
All right.
So it's, you're probably hung up in your back somewhere.
Right,
your,
right, exactly.
Gluteal musculature.
So I would hope you are continuing to see a physical therapist as you are going through your exercise program, because it needs to change with you. If you get to some point where you're just not making any progress, then we talk about other interventions that might be next, and that might mean an injection, it might mean imaging to see if there's some place where you need an injection or changes in the focus of your physical therapy program.
Right. It might not be that the pools may be an okay place for you. It might be what you're doing in the pool. So you need to keep track very closely of the exercises you are doing to see if any of those are a trigger. It might be you need to change up your program, like Lori said.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, so talk with your physical therapist about just that.
Right, and hang with it. Don't throw the towel in. We can get this figured out.
Right.
And Christine called in to say that CBD oil has really helped her with joint pain. Sandra called to say yoga has helped her with joint pain. CBD oil?
Yeah, there's a number of patients who have reported to me that has been helping them with their joint pain. It's, again, a fairly individual thing, and I would say talk it over with your healthcare provider, your pharmacist, about whether it's the right thing for you. And yoga, again, is a great activity if you're doing it correctly with a good instructor.
Right.
Yeah, because it can be a problem if you're not doing it correctly.
Right, right, exactly.
And often we start people in physical therapy, and if they're interested in yoga, we can give them some beginning yoga things and then help them modify their regular yoga program so it can be safe for whatever condition they have.
Talking today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the University of Wisconsin. They are physical therapists. Always great to have them with us. They'll be right here on the microphones until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Taking a look at physical therapy issues today, we're talking physical therapy advice, exercise, and genetics with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. I'm Larry Mueller, and we have two open lines, so you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And you know what? Let's go right back to the phones. Laura in De Pere has something for us. Hi, Laura. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in knowing what could be done for three joint replacements I'm told I have to have. It would be shoulder, hip, and thumb. And I really don't want to have any surgeries, and I'm wondering what I can all do to avoid them.
Oh, good question. So I assume you've been to physical therapy and have done the requisite exercises to help with your shoulder and your hip and so
thumb.
On.
And thumb.
Yes.
And thumb. And do you have splints and such for your thumbs?
Do I have what? I'm sorry.
Splints?
Oh, a splint. Yes, I have that.
Okay. All right. And you've modified, for example, the tools that you work with in your kitchen or your garden or things like that?
As best I can, yes.
Okay. All right. And you're doing a regular exercise program of strengthening for your shoulder and your hip?
No, I am not. I stopped exercising because the pain was too bad. I started going to a Feldenkrais class. Mm-hmm. Which is not to be seen as exercise, but it has helped me immensely.
Sure.
I'm getting a lot of benefit from that. I've gotten cortisone shots that are very effective, but they tell me you're limited to three.
Yes, typically. Typically you are, yes.
Is that in a lifetime or a year?
Usually a year.
Yep.
How long can you continue to have those then into the next year and the next year?
Well, usually at some point they say that the cortisone load in your body is going to be too much. They look at blood tests and things like that to see if it's having an effect on some of your organs. And they look for signs that you're getting too much cortisone. So,
individual, that's
one way. Individual, yeah.
And it sounds like you're doing a lot. If you're going to Feldenkrais course or taking Feldenkrais classes, which is great, is this limiting you from other things? It sounds like, is pain limiting you? Tell us about where you are with that.
The pain comes and goes, but, arthritis. Okay. For instance, I stopped walking because it was so bad in my big toe.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think it was good for me because I was adjusting my gait and
stuff. Have you tried exercising in a pool?
Yeah, I have. That hurts my shoulder.
Okay.
But maybe I just shouldn't incorporate the shoulder in the pool.
Right. Correct.
That's exactly right.
Right, you are exactly right. And there are things that you can do to strengthen your shoulders or to maintain the strength in your shoulders in the pool without actually moving your shoulders. So seeing somebody who can design the right program for you, given the multiple joint you have arthritis,
right,
will help delay these surgeries. And then when do you have surgery? As our surgeons say, you have surgery when the bad days are winning, or when your world gets so small because you continue to cut out this and you cut out that and you stop doing this because you have pain or it's too difficult to get there or I can't do the stairs or whatever. When your world gets small, then it's time to say, okay, I need to make a change there. And then you prioritize
which
joint to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you're good at explaining your condition, Laura, so she needs to talk with her.
Yeah. I think getting back in the pool and having someone reconfigure your program,
right,
considering these things, because you shouldn't be getting shoulder pain in the pool.
Right. Yeah, right.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much, Laura, for calling. And let's turn to Barbara in Green Bay next. Hi, Barbara. Barbara, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
What can we do for you?
Yes. Is there any answer for chronic IT band syndrome?
Where is your pain with it, Barbara? Is it in your hips or in your knees or along the sides of your legs?
It actually runs from the hip down into the knee.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
And it's more painful in the knee, at the knee joint.
Okay. All right. And what things bring your symptoms on?
Climbing.
Like what, stairs?
Going upstairs.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Have you seen a physical therapist?
Yes.
Did they give you strengthening exercises for your gluteus medius and posterior hip?
Yes.
And you've done those religiously?
Religiously.
Oh, good for you. Making my job much harder. So I'm going to look at my sister.
I know. So do they give you also like foam rolling and such for the IT band?
Yeah, I've been doing the foam rolling and dry needling.
Okay. Good.
So
that was my next thing.
Yeah. So you may want to go the other direction with the IT band stuff. So, you know, ideally we're trying to stretch it and lengthen it. So certainly stretching around your glutes and stretching through your hips would be really important. And then there's some who feel like the foam rolling compression is not good. So then we get a little plunger.
Mm-hmm. Or cups.
Yeah. Well, you can get a little plunger. You can order them online, or I think you can get them. Can you get them at the Dorn Hardware?
You can get them at a hardware store, but you want a sink plunger, not a toilet plunger.
Yes, a sink plunger. And then you put a little bit of like Vaseline around the edge of it and put it down in that IT band and take the air out and you pull it out. So you're actually stretching it the other direction, pulling it out rather than pushing it in. So that's one thing that people sometimes have are successful with. Is this one side or both?
The left is worse than the right, but the right is starting to act up also.
Okay.
So then the other thing I would definitely look at is just making sure that your how you're walking, moving, mm-hmm. everything like that. Like you're moving in a stable core. Because I'm wondering if you're like dropping a hip a lot when you walk or anything like that.
Or so, if she's got some internal rotation in her hips,
some aversion
that's perpetuating the problem.
Because
it should respond to a treatment. So if it isn't, you wonder why it's not, and you want someone to look at that. So looking at your mechanics, really from your hips to the floor, and looking at your core strength and how you move would be another facet to this.
Right, right.
Somebody else would be looking at that for her?
Yeah, like a good physical therapist.
Right. I would see a physical therapist who specializes in orthopedics, so an orthopedic clinical specialist or a sports clinical specialist, and there are quite a few of those in your area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there
so
you go.
So maybe another different pair of eyes may be beneficial for you, Barbara.
Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Tim in Green Bay, it's your turn.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been dealing with plantar fasciitis for the last 2 years and just returned to work today after 10 weeks with an air cast boot. And it's making my heel pain not as bad. But I've been getting the kind of a rigid toe and a little numbness there. So my doctor recommended to see a neurologist. I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
So you've had this rigid toe. Is it since you were in the boot?
No, I've been actually a doctor about a year ago saw in the x-ray kind of a squaring off of the big toe.
So,
and which kind of piggybacked on the previous call, which that changed my gait and some hip.
Yeah.
And the plantar fasciitis. So it's your big toe arthritis in your big toe?
Yep. And now it's in both feet. And they're very tight in the morning. The front of my foot, the bottom is very tight, but then also a little bit of numbness. So I was wondering what you thought would you recommend a neurologist to work on that?
Well, I'm wondering why he sent you to a neurologist. So he's thinking about
like a neuropathy?
Neuropathy. I think he wants to rule out any other systemic cause of the numbness in your foot. Then the other way you could go is a mechanical approach. And I don't know what your feet look like, but if you're flat-footed and pronate a lot, you can develop some rigidity in that joint, because instead of rolling off that joint and flexing that joint with every step you take, you roll off the inside, and so that joint never gets moved through the range it's supposed to. So over time it can become rigid. And then at the same time, if you are really flat-footed, you can get something called tarsal tunnel, and that can create some numbness in the area too. So I would say seeing the neurologist, particularly because your physician suggested that, and then seeing an orthopedic physical therapist to look at your foot and leg mechanics, to look at it through that lens, would be sort of a double-pronged approach.
Right, I agree.
Good luck. Thanks, Tim, for calling. And Steve in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you. I have tendonitis in my left elbow, and I saw a sports medicine doctor back in August, and he didn't do any x-rays or scans, anything like that, but gave me a physical type workup. And he injected me with cortisone, and lo and behold, couple days later, I just felt super. Also gave me some exercises to do, which I did for about 2-3 weeks, and you know, I felt better, so I quit doing the exercise.
Of course you did.
Well, about 2 weeks ago it started coming back.
Yeah,
so I started doing the exercises again, and it's not going away, it's just getting worse.
Okay.
I'm wondering, is it too early to have another cortisone?
Ooh, yes. It's, you know what it's time for, Steve? It is time for you to see a physical therapist, because I hear you say that exercises got you better the first time after you had this injection, but it would be very helpful to see a physical therapist and make sure that you get a program that is designed specifically for you based on your strength, range of motion, and ability. So I would go down the path of really trying a very specific, well-designed upper quarter strengthening and mobility program
first. Right. And repeated cortisone injections in that area will lead you down a path you don't want to go.
Right.
So the natural history of repeated cortisone injections there are do not have a good outcome. So, and as you can see, it just came back again. So A, figuring out the cause of the problem. What is it that you're
right.
doing that's perpetuating this problem? And then getting the correct dosage of the exercises. Because as I always say to my patients, and I'm going to try not to jump up and down here on a chair, is it's not do these exercises, exercises yes or exercises no, but which exercises and how do you do them? So, you know, for some people, giving someone a handout and say, yeah, here, go to these exercises right. and you'll get better. That may work for some people, but for lots of people, that doesn't work. They need the exercises specific. Oh, don't lift quite as far. Oh, your hand is turned a little bit too far that way. That's why that exercise is hurting you. So getting someone who can look at what you're doing and really tailor a program for you makes good sense.
Yeah.
There you go. Good luck, Steve. Thank you for calling. Karen in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I try to make this brief, but I'm very sedentary, and every time I try to get not sedentary, I end up injuring myself. I'm currently seeing a PT for I pulled a ligament in the inside part of my foot. That's been going on for like 6 weeks or whatever. I was also told I have tennis elbow, which I've never done tennis in my
right.
life. anything I do just seems, because I'm just so out of shape, I end up injuring myself. I did a few years ago go to the Y, had a trainer, you know, that they helped. That got injured. I don't know how, if there's something I can do at home to slowly strengthen my body.
Right, to get ready for exercises, yeah.
So,
yeah, to be able to do day-to-day stuff, you know.
Karen, do you feel like you're fairly flexible? Like, are your joints and muscles pretty flexible?
I think they are. My one knee is, I broke it about 17, 18 years ago rather severely. It doesn't bend all the way. I can't go up and down steps normally, you know, because it doesn't bend quite a bit. So that changes my gait, a bit, obviously, with that. But everything else, I think I'm fairly flexible.
I'm
62, so, you know, whatever that means.
Okay.
Well, first of all, kudos to you for being interested and trying to start a program and get healthy. And I'm sorry that every time you do this, it's one step forward and two steps backwards.
So you are currently seeing a physical therapist. I would want you to be screened for a connective tissue dysfunction. So I wonder if you're hypermobile. So people who are taller can have connective tissue issues where they're more mobile, their joints are more mobile, their tendons are more mobile, and they tend to get injured more frequently. So the first thing I would want is for you to be screened for hypermobility. And then if you're not hypermobile, then working with that physical therapist with the great question that you articulated so well, you may need to start off in a pool where you have less weight on your knee and on your foot. And if your knee doesn't straighten all the way, it does affect your gait. And you really should potentially have a lift maybe in a shoe to even yourself out. Or, you know, there's lots of issues that come to mind here that I would hope your physical therapist is addressing.
Right. And the other thing is, like you said, if we have this knee that doesn't fully extend, the question is, are you overloading the other leg and is that becoming problematic? So I think there are probably multiple venues in which you can ultimately use to exercise, but I do think starting in the pool is probably a really good strategy for you.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Yeah, but good for you. Keep after it, Karen.
Exactly.
Thanks, Karen. Appreciate it. Rosie and Ashland, we turn to you next. Hi, Rosie.
Hi there. I have a friend who put off getting a hip replaced for
once. She had good reasons, but still. And seemed to get along all right. But, boy, since the surgery, she got her joy back.
Oh, that's
it's
great to hear.
Amazing. We hadn't seen it slipping away, you know.
So that's a great thing to hear. You know, joint replacements are continually improving. The life expectancy of joint replacements is continually getting longer, which is great because our life expectancy is getting longer. So you want to make sure that those joints last a long time. So,
right. And interestingly, she said, you know, we didn't notice the joy sort
right.
of seeping out of her. And that's what I mean when I say your world is getting smaller.
Right.
You stop going to coffee with your friends because it's too hard to get in and out of the car, or you can't sit long enough because of your back pain. So you stop doing that, or you don't go to the movies anymore, or, you know, you have someone else do your shopping for you. You know, those are the signs that you're becoming too inactive and your world's getting too small.
Right.
Thank you, Rosie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa in Amberg, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I go to the VA in Iron Mountain, and I just have to brag on them. I have had problems with my upper back since I was in the lower 20s.
Oh, we're losing you, Lisa. I am so sorry. Well, she's put in a good word for her VA and the PT work that they've done with her.
That's really nice to hear.
That's great.
Yeah.
I wish we could have kept you on, Lisa. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. Well, kudos to the Iron Mountain physical therapist at the VA there. So
correct.
Thanks
yeah.
for doing your good work.
And kudos to Lisa for being compliant with her home exercise program, because
mm-hmm.
exercises don't work if the sheet just lays on the kitchen table.
Right.
There you go.
Right.
Mary Lou emailed to say she was recently diagnosed with inflamed, is it sesamoid?
Sesamoid, mm-hmm.
Near the base of her big toe. How can she get back to her 1 or 2 mile walk every morning?
Well, that's a great question. This kind of follows up with the question we talked about earlier with the great toe. Every time you walk, you have to push off that first your first big toe in about 50 to 70 degrees of extension. The sesamoid bones lie on the bottom of that. So every time you push off, you're weight bearing through those sesamoids and the tendons that run through it. So she might be best suited to cross train for a little bit, perhaps do some stationary biking, some swimming or something like that. To let that inflammation calm down a little bit and then slowly resume walking, starting with, it sounds like she used to walk 1 to 2 miles, starting with probably walking a half a mile or so.
Right. And the rule of thumb is you need to be able to do that program for 3 consecutive sessions without an increase in symptoms before you increase. And then the rule of thumb for increasing kind of depends upon what it is, but probably no more than 20% of what she was doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. Yeah. The other thing would maybe be your shoes.
Right.
Consider a rocker bottom shoe.
Right. And the other thing is when you do start this walk, you want to make sure that you stay relatively close to home. So if you do get a flare up, you're not, you know, a mile away from home and then have to turn around and walk back. A track is nice for that reason. Some mall walking where you can sit and rest is also a good strategy.
Yeah, especially this time of year.
Correct. Correct.
Exactly.
For sure.
Now, the one thing I'll say about a mall versus a track, though, is the track is cushioned.
Correct.
Which is way better than a mall, which is generally tile over cement, which
right.
will give you back every pound you put into it.
Right.
And on that happy note, we'll conclude. You guys are back December 17th. We'll do this all over again. Thank
awesome.
You so much. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Well, tomorrow at 11, Shyla Mergain back to talk about coping with the upcoming holidays, and then we'll take a look at Tex-Mex cooking. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.